continuing with Vipassana insight meditation, reflections on that, on anicca, on impermanence. The perception of time, for example, is those reflecting on that this morning, something to contemplate. How much we, our whole mind, attitude, civilization is based on a kind of believing in time as the real world, the past, the future. Because of that, we can carry resentments from the past, and of course that affects us in the present. But if we don't realize what's happening, then always we can just our mind is always planning, looking forward or dreading the future, or remembering the past. The future is the unknown. So, I mean, this is to recognize that we don't know the future. It could be anything. Tomorrow could bring anything. Success, failure, praise, blame, mixtures of the whole lot. It might be the end of the world tomorrow. Maybe the sky will fall in. Maybe the planet will fall out of the solar system. Maybe the sun will go out. Unknown. And the past is when we look forward maybe to a golden age in the future. We think of hopefully that we will that we're evolving to some kind of thing where everything's going to be all right. We're going to reach a kind of peak and stabilize ourselves on a peak of some sort. And I think here in Britain, having many of you, and not all that many of you, where some of you were born before the British Empire fell in. And so, and most of you were born after that, so it was, you can see that things like that reached their peak. When I was born in the 30s, Britain was the superpower, was the world power. It was I was born in America, but then Britain was the world leader, the superpower of that time. And then after the World War II, everything were kind of slipped away. And that's a reflection on how, when the mind thinks in terms of, you get fixed ideas about things, and it's hard to change those. It's hard, I think, for people, British people who were brought up the time of the empire to be able to accept that it no longer is that way, because the mind wants to hold on to maybe the past, when you remember maybe a time in the past where you felt you were on a winning team, or that everything was much better. Or maybe there's this hope that sometime in the future we'll reach this golden age, the Aquarian age. But the present is where everything's taking place. Here and now is where we're breathing, where we're feeling, where we're experiencing life. And the past is, we can think about it, we can remember it, but it is merely just a function of the mind, isn't it? The past is a function of our mind, and the future is the unknown, the mind that doesn't know. And the past is what we remember. So pointing to the realm we're in is a realm of knowing things, consciousness, knowing as a subject, as a subjective experience. So we're taking knowing to the knowing of Dhamma, or the way it is, rather than knowing about things. Like most of us were educated to know about the British Empire, the Roman Empire, the time of the Buddha, the time of Jesus Christ, and we know about them. We've all studied those kind of the histories. Back in the 50s, I remember we all thought that modern science was going to solve all our problems. Modern psychiatry was going to cure all mental illness. It's like we'd gotten rid of tuberculosis and pneumonia. We could then cure all sicknesses, all ailments and mental illnesses through the wizardry of empirical science and modern medicine. There was that in the 50s, 1950s, there was a kind of expectation that we were really on the way to this golden age. And now we look at it in the 90s, and we rather the predictions, the gloom doom, the amount of the world population, the pollution, the AIDS epidemic, the strange sicknesses that never existed back in the 1950s, and gosh. Because we can think that in the future lies everything good is going to, it's all going to kind of be there, hope, expectation. Or we can think when we die, if we live a good life, then we'll go to a nice place forever and live happily ever after in some heavenly state. Put it off for the future, in other words, for when we die and go to heaven, or the golden age in the future, or tomorrow, or look forward to the next holiday, or the next hope that you might win the lottery, or you might, something wonderful might happen, but it might not. The future is what we don't know. So it's the possibilities. And whether we tend to be optimistic or pessimistic, when we think about the future, we might find some kind of happiness out of being optimistic. Everything's going to be all right. Everything's getting better and better in every way. Or the pessimist, thinking it's terrible what's happening, and it's going to get worse and worse. But we can know that in the present, this might be what we're feeling. The future is what we don't know, and maybe we're pessimistic or optimistic about it. Or we don't even bother to consider it. Maybe we're just thinking of the next holiday, or the next thing after the retreat. So this is why in meditation we're emphasizing the here and now, the Dhamma of, the real Dhamma of the way it is. And to be able to use this time well in meditation is to contemplate it in your own experience that you're having on this retreat. The things that come up in your mind, the hopes, or the expectations, or the fears, or the anxieties about the future. Put them in the context of Dhamma, rather than just being caught up into either indulging or suppressing them. Or memories of the past. to see that the memories, that what you remember or the things of the past are a memory in the present. And this isn't a dismissal either of their emotional power, but to note the connection of when we remember unpleasant things of the past, we have emotional reactions. And the future, we have these emotions of like expecting or hoping, anticipating. If you know what that kind of mental state is in the present, like, I hope that the future, hoping is like this. And there's a kind of, you don't know, but you hope. It feels like this, the hope is a, you're kind of contemplating, hope for something right now, and just feel what it's like. It's that, like this, isn't it? Hoping is the mind kind of doesn't know, but there's a kind of, hope always implies some kind of positiveness. Or dread, meaning the future. Oh, when I finish this retreat and I go back, I've got to pay the bills and hope somebody's fed the cat and dread all the getting back to the routine, dreading maybe having to go back to maybe some difficult problems you perceive, you know, family problems or professional problems, dreading having to do this or that. Like when I think of the appeal in November, it's dread. Dread is like that, isn't it? Hope is more... So you're investing as a mental state that we create in our mind. And it's about the unknown, the future. And then the past is a... I remember in noting in the early days of my monastic life, I used to have a kind of set of happy memories that when I'd get bored with all this, I could kind of entertain myself by remembering pleasant things of the past, like a kind of file cabinet of happy memories you could pull out, and you could just kind of distract yourself with happy memories. Or sometimes you'd remember the unhappy times. And like I was telling you about the experience in the military of having bitterness and resentment for some things that happened. When you think, how dare they do that? And how could, this is unfair that things like this should happen. And I'll never forgive them for doing that. It's despicable. You get indignant just remembering something that happened 40 years ago. Because it is really quite timeless. A memory isn't 40 years itself, is it? It's just something, a function of the mind that we remember things. And we remember usually extremities. You don't remember what you had for lunch on 21 September 40 years ago. Unless it was, you nearly died from it, or it was so utterly delicious you could never forget it. If it was just porridge and prunes or something. So most of our life in the past is we don't remember at all. It's totally forgotten, but the kind of peak moments or the depressing, despairing moments we remember through memory has that it's usually about extremity, So in Vipassana meditation, we're remembering, no longer looking, trying to remember the extremity, but remember the norm, the breath, remember the breathing, remember the posture, sitting, standing, walking, lying down, remember the sound of silence. Remember to contemplate the impermanence of things. Because because memories have a kind of static quality to them. When you remember something in the past, it's pretty fixed in its, it's like a cutout or a statue or something. It's not particularly kind of, it doesn't have much life to it. It maybe arouses emotion. But remembering the here and now, that's why we, right now, now is the knowing, now is the sitting, now is the breathing. To recollect, remember, and recall is establishing this mindfulness about the way things are. Then from there, it's not to think that for the rest of our lives we're just going to contemplate our breath, because that that's not, it just doesn't happen. It's not the way things are. But it is a centering practice, isn't it? Reminding you of the present, because we're so used to living in the past and the future. Giving the time, such an importance in our lives, as if it were the real world, the reality of everything. But in the timeless of the present, you say, timelessness is in the present. Eternity is now. Things like this one can reflect upon. And you hear this in various poetry. In poetry, oftentimes, tries to express this truth. Now the Buddha used suffering as the first noble truth. The essential teaching of the Buddha is called the Four Noble Truths. And these are not metaphysical truths. To point out the difference between Buddhism and Christianity, for example, you see, Christianity is a theistic approach. So it approaches from the metaphysical doctrines. So, to be a Christian, you say, I believe in God. And that's approaching your religious path from a metaphysical belief. And Hinduism is highly metaphysical in its emphasis. And theistic religions are, the emphasis is on belief in a higher form or in an ultimate reality, some kind of metaphysical doctrine that is the essential that we must believe in and grasp. And the Buddha didn't proclaim a metaphysical doctrine. He started out on the opposite end with existential experience. There is suffering. So when you're trying to compare Buddhism with a theistic religion, you can really get it all wrong, because it's a different approach. It's the difference between inductive and deductive reasoning. And from a metaphysical approach, you deduct, I believe in God, and then the logic follows from that, from the top down. And the Buddhist approach is there is suffering, which is the most common human experience. Every human being experiences suffering. and then you induct from suffering. There is this suffering, and then you examine it. You go to the suffering, you examine it, you investigate suffering till you see the way of non-suffering, or the deathless, or the metaphysical reality. So to the Buddhist, the metaphysical reality is a realization rather than a doctrine. The aim is to not preconceive it, or to define it, or to say really very much about it, but to point to the where the problem lies, our deluded state, and how to deal with our delusion so that we free the mind from the deludedness, and then there is the realization of ultimate reality. So the Four Noble Truths, they're noble truths rather than metaphysical truths. The first one is just pointing to the experience of suffering, the dukkha. And dukkha is a Pali word which means what we can't bear. In terms of this sense, this du prefix, du, is always conveys some negative thing. Su is always good, like sumato is. means wise, sage. And if you say dumato, it means fool. It does in Pali, if you say dumato. Don't get any ideas. If I start acting foolish, you can refer to me as Ajahn Dumato. But the dukkha is a sense of what we can't bear, can't stand. And so there is this feeling in the human experience, isn't it, of we can't bear things, we can't take it, we can't stand it. This is a common human experience of feeling that the pain we have, or the problems of life, possibilities or everything is something we can't stand, we can't bear it. It's going to be too much for us. It's like when you're dealing with physical pain, your reaction is always, I can't stand it, I want to get rid of it. And as you begin to investigate physical pain, you find out you can stand it if you have to. Is something you can stand, but the suffering is the feeling of I can't bear it, I don't want it. Or suffering is wanting something that you don't have. That I want something, I'm lacking something, I need something that I don't have right now, and I'm suffering because I want it. I want something that I don't have. Or wanting to, we'll say, the desires of, desire is always a, and desire and dukkha are interchangeable and as concepts, and dhanha is, in the Second Noble Truth, the origin of suffering is this desire, grasping desire for things. Like, the gama dhanha, sensual desire, always wanting just sense pleasures, wanting the pleasures of life through the senses, and always seeking, you know, being caught up in just sensuality and seeking pleasure through the senses is gama dhanha. Bhava dhanha is the desire for becoming something. It's more like wanting to succeed, desire to be respected, desire to win the prize, desire to get enlightened, desire to get something or attain something, more on the level of becoming than on the level of sensuality. And then the third kind of desire is vipavadanha, which is desire to get rid of things. Desire to get rid of your anger, desire to get rid of your problems, desire to get rid of things you don't like. Desire to get rid of your depression, or desire to get rid of bad thoughts, the vipavadanha. So desire has, there's three aspects to desire, for sense pleasure, for becoming, and for getting rid of. Now, in the first noble truth, is the statement, there is this suffering. And suffering is to be understood, is the insight. So the Buddha's advice is to understand suffering, which means to open to the suffering, to kind of stand under it, to embrace it. Because usually when we're suffering, we're trying to get rid of it, run away from it, ignore it. So in the First Noble Truth, the Buddha said, understand the suffering. Like, stand under it, accept it. It feels this way, to bear it, rather than to think, I can't bear it, I don't want it. Accept it and let it be what it is. Then you understand it. You're willing to accept it rather than to just react to it with the suffering, with the compounded suffering of, I can't bear it, I don't want it. So we have the insight into that there is this suffering. So this suffering isn't just a kind of a belief in Buddhist teachings or having read a book about the Four Noble Truths that you believe them. The Four Noble Truths are to be investigated. Therefore, meditation, therefore reflection. They're tools to use. And this is very much Lumpa Cha's emphasis in his in the life we led in the monastery in Thailand, was on using these Four Noble Truths as a continuous reflection for what was happening to us. For example, when I lived there and was a newly ordained monk, then I created a lot of suffering for myself because I would be resistant or proud or opinionated or all these things, or lazy. I'd complain. I wouldn't want to do things that I was expected to do. And by contemplating this, then I began to see I was creating suffering around my life. When I contemplated the life itself, say in the monastery, I could say, the one way is to blame everything. Say, my suffering is due to this monastery. My suffering is because it's too hot here, or my suffering is because they want me to do things I don't want to do, and they're being unfair, or they don't really appreciate me or understand me, or I could blame the situation for my suffering. But in a Buddhist monastery, it's hard. It's not. It's difficult to do because, like, basically, it was, it was quite a nice place, and the teacher was very wise, and people were generally quite good to me, and it was, when you really examined it, and thinking that, if you could really, really make a case to blaming it for your suffering, you realized there wasn't a good case, and the suffering wasn't really due to the monastery or anyone in it. It was due to me, feeling annoyed with this, not wanting to do that. And so, like, this is like investigating, looking into what is suffering anyway. is the suffering that's caused externally, is that the real suffering? Is the suffering, the real suffering, what we create around life, about the experiences of life? Say, like, if terminal illness, people get like cancer or AIDS, or find that their life is going to be terminated, and then they can say, this is ruining my life. I'm suffering because of this disease. And that sounds reasonable enough, doesn't it? That seems to be true in a way. That if we didn't have this disease, life would be much better. We think I wouldn't be suffering like this if I didn't have this disease. Or, what is the real suffering? Is it the disease, or is it the fear and the resentment towards the disease? This is something to question and ask yourself in your own life. Is the suffering really the things around us that impinge or irritate us, or is it what we, our aversion, our resentment, our resistance, our stubbornness that we create around it? Now, when people change their attitude, say people that have, say, cancer, change their attitude towards not resenting, not hating the thing, then they still have the cancer, but they don't have all the suffering around it. They have the sensations and all the discomfort, the pain, but that we can bear, actually. We have an amazing ability to bear those things. But what we can't bear, the real dukkha, what we can't bear is our own fears and desires. And those make life unbearable. And the thing you realize is that what life brings to us, most of it we can bear, we can stand it, if we have the right attitude. But we think we can't stand it, and then we suffer. We can suffer even with a toothache, or students commit suicide because they fail their examinations. When I was in the University of California in Berkeley, there's this Campanile Tower, this beautiful tower in the campus of the university, with a lift that goes up to the top. And they used to have it. It used to be quite open. You could go up and kind of look out into the bay across the San Francisco. Went back a few years later, and they had a big wire mesh around the whole thing because students used to go up and throw themselves off the top of this tower when they failed their exam. I mean, that's the suffering, isn't it? We can't bear something like failing an exam. And yet, in an actual experience, it's something we can bear. If we're mindful, we can bear failing exams. That's bearable. But if you think you can't bear it, then you're suffering from, if you fail, then you suffer because you can't, you take it as something you can't bear anymore, so you throw yourself off the tower. Now, this is for reflection and contemplation, just to try to encourage you to examine suffering in terms of what is it that is bearable, like physical pain, it's bearable. But the emotional aversion to it is unbearable. And we create that suffering, we create that suffering, that's something we create out of our ignorance. So we can stop creating it. We don't have to do that. Once we see it, we can stop creating suffering about the way things are, about what we're experiencing. Now, you might think I'm suffering about this appeal in November. But I can bear that. Something one can bear, it's all right. But if I start worrying about it, then I'm suffering. Oh, what might happen? Oh, I have to give evidence, have to be a witness, and have to be cross-examined, and all awful things. And then I'm suffering if I'm creating a lot of negativity around it. But I know that those things are something I can bear. You take them as they come, and you somehow, sometimes they can be surprisingly pleasant or interesting or whatever. But you can imagine, before anything ever happens, that it's going to be absolutely horrible, when it might not be at all. And even if it is, we can bear it. That we can bear, the stuff coming at us from outside, but it's what we compound, what we project onto life out of our ignorance, that is the dukkha the Buddha is pointing to. And that is the dukkha we can let go of. So the second noble truth is the truth of letting go of these desires. So to let go of something doesn't mean you get rid of it, because one of the kind of desires is desire to get rid of things, remember. So letting go doesn't mean throwing everything away or getting rid of things. It means letting things be. Noting them, not trying to, get rid of things you don't like, or trying to, always be in trying to control and manipulate everything around you, but to let go of the world and to watch it, to let it be what it is, and but be alert to it, be aware of it, so that these desires then, because they arise, they cease. So you're letting desire that has arisen, you're letting it cease by letting go of it. So this letting go of desire, to let go of desire, you have to know what desire and attachment are. So one can contemplate the nature of desire as one is desiring things. Not taking the view I shouldn't desire anything. If I were a good Buddhist, I wouldn't desire anything. That's being very idealistic. Isn't it? If I were a proper Buddhist, I wouldn't have desires. Is unrealistic. The Buddha didn't say you shouldn't have desires. He said to understand desires and to let go of them, not to get rid of them, but to know the desires as desire, so that it doesn't delude you. That kind of energy that's always wanting something or wanting to get rid of something. That sense of, notice that tension in your mind and how, just wanting and desires aiming at anything. Whatever is around you, you find just yourself, the desire will go towards it. Or a lot of the desires, say, of a spiritually evolving person is desire to get rid of things. They're kind of righteous desires, like desire to get rid of anger. That seems like a good thing to desire, doesn't it? To get rid of anger, not be angry. To get rid of jealousy. Jealousy is awful, isn't it? And to get rid of it, I desire to get rid of it, sounds like a righteous kind of desire. It's right to desire to get rid of it. Sometimes when you're getting into the spiritual development, you can be taken over by high-minded desires, which is one of the dangers of religion, isn't it? The holier-than-thou problems and the desire to kill the devil. Isn't it? The desire to annihilate evil. they have a kind of righteous quality to them. They sound like they're right. But there's a whole history, isn't there? The history of religion is filled with the kind of self-righteous hypocrisy. Isn't that it's one of the problems all religions have, is that one can be caught in one's own sense of rightness and not see the attachment to the desire to get rid of maybe the heretic, or the desire to get rid of the infidel, or the desire to thinking that burning the witches is getting rid of evil, or that we should kill off the evil demons, or we should destroy that terrible group of people that are doing everything wrong, or this ethnic cleansing in Yugoslavia, or all these kind of things that they're this idea of racial purity and protecting the religion by killing off its enemies, or you know, protecting the Bible by killing off those who want to destroy the Bible. Always this, the logic is there, the kind of from the dualistic mind, but in the act of trying to destroy in the name of God or righteousness, is this vipavadanha, the desire to get rid of. And then it takes us to suffering, to increased amount of suffering. And if you notice in religions, the way that proper religions, true religions, don't destroy evil. They aren't destroying or annihilating evil. They're understanding it. They know what it is. So the Buddha, when Mara is the tempter or the devil in Buddhism, when Mara would tempt the Buddha would say, I know you, you know, you can't fool me. And so the way of the Buddha is to see things clearly so that the evil has no power. Because evil things have power through delusion, through creating this desire in your mind to either get something you don't have or get rid of something. Evil has if it can frighten you, it can keep you frightened and anxious, then it has power over you. If you're frightened of evil, if you hate it and want to destroy it, then it has power. So the aim of the Buddha is to understand evil, know it, know what it is. I know you, Mara. You can't fool me. You can't delude me. So this is why we reflect on the evil, good and evil aren't fixed absolutes. They're relative, aren't they? There's no absolute kind of fixed goodness or evilness. These are words that imply a state of change and relativity. So when you try to absolutize good, like saying, you could say, Christianity is good. And that's it. You know, you kind of made your statement and it's good, kind of permanently good. But that's not really the case, is it? Goodness is determined by time and place. You can use, you know, like a Buddha Rupa, Buddha image. You could use it to inspire your mind, to remember the Buddha, to reflect on the virtues of the Buddha, to encourage you in your practice, to emulate the Buddha. You could use it for all kinds of good things, or you could use it to bash somebody over the head with. So the Buddha Rupa, its goodness is determined on how you use it, isn't it? It's up to you. It's not in itself, it is what it is. It's neither good nor bad, it is what it is. But when we use it in the right way, what is it intended for, like this Buddha Rupa? What is its purpose? If it's for spiritual liberation, and then we learn how to relate to it in a way that it encourages that. Or we could use it as a weapon. A few years back, there was a group down in Bognor Regis, some kind of fundamentalist Christian group, down on the coast. They had little pamphlets they were passing out with a cross breaking a Buddha Rupa. This Christian cross, and it was hitting this Buddha Rupa. And this fundamentalist group was against all other religions and Buddhism. And they must have known about us. I don't know why they particularly chose Buddhism, but I began to take it quite personally. In fact, it's a kind of ugly picture, but it was, it was a poorly drawn cartoon, actually. But it was meant in all seriousness that Christianity is that which destroys these pagan religions, these forces of evil. And so actually the cross was being used as a weapon to hit the Buddha, to kill the Buddha. And this is the kind of primitive thinking of fundamentalists, isn't it? So a cross, in the proper use of Christian symbolism, is a cross used to be used as a weapon to destroy things? But it can be used as a weapon to destroy things, isn't it? It's not because it was meant to be that, but it was, that's not what its symbolic value is in, but it can be used for that. So good and evil are relative to, that's where we need the wisdom to be able to have that sense of what is appropriate now, what is right now, because there's no absolute right or wrong. And that takes the wisdom, isn't it? The mind in its open reflective state to be able to respond to the changingness of life, rather than to try to freeze life in fixed perceptions. Because it doesn't work that way. Life isn't. This is a dynamic flow and movement, the energy that we're all involved with. But we can kind of fix on it with our ability to think. We can freeze things, and we can live in the realm of our own thinking, with absolutizing relative things. We can create the impression that there is an absolute right and wrong, and I'm the one that knows. These are right, those are wrong. Those you get rid of, those you doubt. And that's one thing I think we've all felt in the old Christian attitude that I was brought up with, was that Christianity was right and every other religion was wrong. So absolutely sure. At least my background of Christianity was very much Christianity was right, and that made everything else wrong, because the mind tended to get stuck in these perceptions. They tended to have a kind of absolute fixity to them. But when you're investigating Dhamma, you realize it's right and wrong, good and bad are relative, because everything is in the process of changing. Nothing's ever the same. And to be able to to contemplate change, then this anicca is a way of sharpening our wisdom sword, our faculty for understanding and knowing things as they are. So the first two noble truths, first noble truth is there is suffering, there is dukkha. Dukkha should be understood. Now this is the going to the to admit it, to know it, to feel it. Feel the dukkha, feel the suffering, embrace it, stand under it. So you're actually with it, accepting it for what it is. Then you can see that the suffering, you can investigate this suffering. If you've got it and you're looking at it and you're not just reacting with aversion to it and want to get rid of it, when you actually willingly accept it, then you can contemplate it and you begin to see why the suffering is there. It's because due to this attachment to desires, wanting something you don't have, not wanting what you have. And so the insight into the second noble truth is letting go of desire. And you can trace all suffering to grasping of desire. If in your life, if you're suffering, it's because you're grasping something. Like wanting, one of the forms of suffering that parents have is wanting their children to be good and respectful and obedient, and grasping that desire and then feeling upset and hurt when the children aren't that way. So one can be can suffer a lot because you want the world to be some way that it's not. And so when you let go of that desire, then you find that you can deal with the actual problems much better when you're not grasping a desire for them to be some other way. Being abbot of a monastery, I can suffer in this position of being abbot of Amaravati. When I want Amaravati to be harmonious, and I used to be want everybody to be in the morning chanting, 5 o'clock. I used to suffer a lot. That one. And wanting all the monks to be at the morning chanting. And then I realized that wanting all the monks to be at the morning chanting and grasping that desire was suffering. Grasping that desire, wanting them something to be something that it seldom ever is. So... So one, not the kind of fatalistic resignation, but it is willingness to let go of the desire anyway, and so that you're not suffering. There's no point in suffering about these things because it serves no purpose. It tends to doesn't do anyone any good. Me or anyone else. When you see it, so then you realize that to let go of it. So when you want everyone to be the morning chanting, you know that that's some mental state that you don't grasp. So you don't suffer when, as say, you find you go there and only 3 or 4 monks are there. Or wanting the Sangha to be in harmony all the time. We have, this isn't such a problem with me, but some monks are harmony fanatics. Any sign of disharmony, they can't bear it. And so they want harmony all the time, you know. They get very upset when there isn't, when there's signs of disharmony. So the desire even to have everyone get along and everyone to be in a harmonious relationship, that grasping of that desire will always bring suffering, because, you know, you're all right when things are going well, but when they start changing, then you suffer. You feel angry or disappointed or let down by things when they change. And they do change. You can't have permanent harmony in a community. It has to go through periods of disharmony. It has to, I think that's the way life is. People are going through their own changing experiences, and you can't just try to command them to be harmonious. The kind of tyranny, isn't it, where you will be harmonious. Hold a stick up. Yeah. Wanting people to understand you when they don't. Not suffering. Wanting you can see the suffering in of wanting in politics, say, for example, always thinking that the next election we'll get we hope to get the right one in. The one that exists usually, the one that's in the present position usually has let us down by now, isn't it? John Major he's kind of let us down. We wanted him to be able to solve all the problems, and he hasn't. Next one, we'll try to elect someone next time who will be able to do that. And it's like, you know, wanting the Prime Minister to be able to solve all the economic, political problems when they can't or won't. So wanting something you don't have, or not wanting what you have, is this kind of desire. Look at it, admit it, take an interest in the desire, not in the objects of desire, but in the actual desiringness of desire. That sense of feeling always wanting something, to absorb into something. Or to get rid of things, wanting to get rid of the problems in your family, wanting to get rid of the noisy neighbors or the sound of traffic out on the street, or wanting to get rid of all kinds of things, is that we, the grasping of this desire is suffering. So investigate that. Take this and kind of just contemplate it. What is the suffering? And what is grasping? What is desire? These three words. Suffering, dukkha, and desire is dhanha, and grasping is upadana. So that these are for investigation, for examination, to get to know them. So that when these things happen, you can say, I know you, Mara. You've taken away the power of delusion, of evil. Evil has no power if you know it. Completely disempowered the devil. So instead of killing the devil, you just disempower the devil. Take away his power. This is the way of a Buddha. So now, go back to the here and now.